Good afternoon. Good afternoon. The class today is dedicated by Ellen in memory of her father, Leon Kantrowitz, Aryeh Ben Avraham Zalman, who, of course, I knew as well, growing up down the block. Okay, we are up to Perek Daled, Chapter 4 in Nehemiah. As a reminder of what's been going on, right? Chapter 3 saw the construction of the walls of Jerusalem, not the completion of the construction, but the breakdown of who was supposed to build which sections. We talked a lot about the strategy that Nehemiah brought to bear in the construction process, who was selected, where they were going to do it, the fact that he is so focused on the details of who did what, and he wants to list everything, fits the personality that we're starting to recognize within Nehemiah. Sorry, I'm giving a class on Daniel tomorrow. We then saw the response of the Samaritans to this. And what I titled Trash Talk, essentially, Sanballat and Tovia make fun of the efforts of the Jews. They aren't going to succeed in completing this. They aren't going to succeed in dedicating it. This is a hopeless cause. And even if they do build this, it's going to collapse. A fox could knock it down. We have nothing to worry about from these Jews. And Nehemiah's response at the end of chapter 3 is to pray to God and to say, listen, God, hear what they're saying about us. And then he says the wall construction continues, the wall reaches halfway, and everybody is energized. We want to build. And that's where we left off at the end of Perek Gimel, the end of chapter 3, which brings us to chapter 4. If you're using the Art Scroll Stone Tanakh, you're on page 1845. And here, Debbie, is where we get to some action. Okay. Not just building, fighting also. War and defense. So we're going to read first, I think, Psukim Aleph Teches, sentences 1-8, and see what happens here. Vayhi kasher shama Sanballat v'Tobia v'ha'aravim v'ha'amonim v'ha'ashdodim ki alasa arucha l'chamos Yerushalayim ki eichelu ha'prutzim lihisasein vayichar lohem me'od. Okay, the Sanballat, Tobia, we know them, two out of the three leaders of the enemy we've talked about. The other one was Geshem, right? The third, Geshem HaAravi. So the two of them, as well as the Aravim, Arabs, Ammonim, people of Ammon, Ashdodim, that's a new nationality for us. Yes. They're going to come up a few times in Nehemiah. What does it sound like they are? They're from Ashdod. Sorry. Right, so exactly. So the question that Janine asks is, well, don't we call them Plishtim? And the answer may be that these are no longer Plishtim. Remember, the Assyrians conquered the area and transferred populations. So these are residents of Ashdod, and Ashdod being a major city at this point, but presumably not the only city in which they live. You have a bunch of cities that are in that area. I did read one article on this period that said Ashdod would soon go into decline, and Ekron, I think, would become a more important city. But right now, Ashdod is important enough that they are identified as Ashdodim. So they here, by the way, notice the geography? I should have noted that. You notice the geography here. You're surrounded on all sides. Right? Who's to your north? In this list?
I would guess Ammon.
No. The Samaritans. Right? The Samaritans are to your north. Right? To your west, you have the Ashdodim. Right? Ashdod would be west. To your east, well, it's west and south, effectively. To your east, you have Ammon. Right? And it's really east-southeast. And then Arabia to your south. That's your, so you're basically facing people on all sides. And they hear that the walls of Yerushalayim alsa arucha. We're going to come back to that phrase. It's a very interesting phrase. But it's that they're being repaired. That the gaps in the wall are being sealed. And Vayichar Lahem Me'od, they are angry. I found that a very interesting verb, that they are angry. My inclination when I first saw it was to say, well, they're upset. Maybe they're afraid. Maybe they, you know, but anger, it sounds like someone's offended you. So I went looking throughout Tanakh at the use of Vayichar, and really, it's always a display of anger. Yeah, can't find another a use of Vayichar that is not a display of anger. So it isn't just that they are upset because now the Jews are going to build the wall, and now they'll be able to defend themselves, and now they won't be subject to us. I think they're genuinely offended. I think there's an expression of being offended. Who are these upstarts who just came in here and started building the wall of this city? They're offended by this. They're angry. So what do they do? Pasuk Beis. Vayikshiru chulam yachdav lavo lihilachem birushalayim. They knotted together. They created a conspiracy. Kesher is used often in Tanakh to refer to a conspiracy. They conspired together to fight against Yerushalayim. V'lasos lo to'ah. To'ah is a funny word. We find it used in Chumash to refer to somebody being lost. Not to'ah with a tet, to make a mistake, but to'ah with a tav. Yosef. When Yosef is looking for his brothers and he can't find them, so it's to stray, to wander, to be lost. I see that the Art Scroll translates it here as to bring ruin upon it, which is interesting. Generally speaking, you see two different explanations. Either they wanted to cause us to go astray in building. They can't necessarily oppose us directly. They want to try to do something that will cause us to go astray in building. Or alternatively, Ralbag says, they wanted to fool us so that we wouldn't recognize the attack that was coming. They tried tactics which would conceal their initiative. Okay, so you know what? I'm going to stop with these two psukim, just to pause here before we go further. The Jews are surrounded on all sides. Each of these populations is under the control of the Assyrians fundamentally, and I thought that they should not. Sorry, I'm sorry. Not the Assyrians, the Persians. Now the they're under the control of the Persians. They have local pachas, but they're under Persian control. I would have expected that they would not dare to attack, and indeed until now they didn't dare to attack, but they're so angry that they've decided it's worth the risk of launching an attack against the Jews. That's what they're ready to do. Yeah?
But does that mean that perhaps their major cities were not allowed to have walls?
So I will go back to our brief email exchange. Did you look into that? Oh, neither did I. We were discussing the question. Sharon had a very good question. The question was, what was the status of walled cities back in the day? At this period of time, was it common? Was it uncommon? And and I said to her, now you have homework. I'm pretty sure I did.
It took a long time to answer.
Yes. Okay. Pretty sure there was something there. But okay. It is a good question. By the time you hit the Gemara, it's considered shameful to not have a wall. It's considered to be, it connotes a lower status. Regarding Purim, since Purim is in the offing here, we have this very odd practice. I think I must have mentioned this at some point since we started Ezra. We have this very odd practice. We have two different days for Purim, right? The 14th of Adar and the 15th of Adar. Why do we have two different days?
For the walled city.
Why? And do we have two different Pesachs? One for the walled city, one for the non-walled city? What is that about? So the answer is, if you read the Megillah, you find out that the city of Shushan continued fighting for an extra day, and therefore we are told all the open cities, they observe Purim on the 14th day of Adar, the day that they rested. And Shushan observes Purim on the 15th day of Adar, the day that they rested. Everybody else fought on the 13th. They fought on the 13th and the 14th. But that explains nothing about our practice. Because our practice is not everybody but Shushan observes Purim on the 13th of Adar, on the 14th of Adar, and Shushan observes it on the 15th. We say walled cities in general observe it on the 15th. We extrapolate from Shushan to walled cities. And not only that, which walled cities are the ones that observe on the 15th? No. If they had a wall in the time of Yahushua ben Nun, who cares if they had a wall in the time of Yahushua ben Nun? What does that have to do with Purim? The answer is nothing. Says the, I think it's Yerushalmi, that the reason why we say if you had a wall from the days of Yahushua is because if you took the later date, if you took the date of Purim, Yerushalayim would not have had a wall. Yerushalayim didn't have a wall at that point. And it would be insulting to say Yerushalayim is an open city. Having a wall connoted a certain stability, a certain permanence. And you couldn't do that. So therefore, they backdated it and said, if you had a wall from the times of Yahushua, you're grandfathered in. And therefore, Yerushalayim ends up observing on the 15th day, like Shushan does. My point in bringing this is only to show you that in the days of Purim, as read by the Gemara, it's considered to be a sign of stability that you have a wall. That does not answer the question of the cities of all of these leaders. The cities of all these opponents. That I don't know. So I wanted to point you though to a particular turn of phrase because I think it's really interesting. The phrase used for what happens to the wall. In the process of the building. You notice that? Al-Sa'arucha. So, Al-Sa'arucha, they translate here in the English as, we're being healed. They were being healed. That's actually an accurate translation of the words. That's what those words mean. If you go back to Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, I gave it to you on your sheet in source number 1. You can see the references there. Chapter 30, sentence 17. It is on page 1143. This is Yirmiyahu speaking to the Jews of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem. And he says, Ki a'ale arucha lach u'imakosayich erpa'ech. I am going to heal you. I am going to heal you. I'm going to heal you from your wounds. It's an expression of physical healing. You find another example of it in the 33rd chapter in Yirmiyahu. I'm not going to flip to that right now. Instead, I'm going to have you turn to Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 18, sentence 30. Page 859. What is being repaired or healed in that pasuk? Mizbeach, right? The Mizbeach on Har HaKarmel, right? When Elio has his showdown with the prophets of the Baal, so the prophets of the Baal build themselves a brand new altar that they're going to use in order to bring their sacrifice. Elio does not. Elio takes the altar of God, an old altar of God that is no longer in use, and he says, I'm going to fix this up. And the image there is, he's restoring that which had been. We have roots here. We are restoring that which we already had. And so he wants to bring the offering on this old Mizbeach, this old altar. And it says he heals the altar that had been ruined. Right? Vayirapeh is what it actually says. Vayirapeh es ha'avanim, right? Something along those lines. Vayirapeh et ha'mizbeach. He healed the Mizbeach. Similarly, I gave you another reference on your sheet. I'm not going to have you flip through everything. But in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Chronicles 2, we have the Beis HaMikdash having its stones healed. And then the last reference is one that we actually saw in the previous chapter. Chapter 3, sentence 34. We didn't take note of it at the time. In Sanballat's speech, when Sanballat is making fun of the Jews, he says, Hayizbachu, are they going to bring their dedication offerings? Hayechalu vayom, are they going to finish it by day? Hayechayu es ha'avanim. will they give the stones life? These stones are alive, is the image here. And Sanballat recognizes it as well. There is life in the stones as well. There's a recognition of the stakes that are involved. We're talking about more than construction. This is an act of healing. Sorry?
It doesn't have to do with ownership. We were here before. This is ours.
Yeah.
This is ours before. This is ours in perpetuity.
Right.
It has to do with archaeology going on in Israel into perpetuity. This has to do with...
Right. Certainly there's an element of ownership, yes, and historical connection.
And God-given.
Yes. But I think a lot of it really is that this is a healing for the nation. Every stone that they repair is an act of healing.
From God.
I'm not sure why you asked that.
Well, the whole theological...
I mean, they continue to look at it all as coming from God. Yes, Nehemiah every step of the way takes pains to say so.
This is ours from God.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's true. I'm trying to get at the fact that it's therapeutic for them. That's what I've
therapeutic from them. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I think is really interesting here. Also, note it said that vayikshiru, right? As I said, they conspired. It's a classic word in Tanakh. But if you go back to the last sentence in chapter 3, vatikasher kol hachoma. So it's a play on words. Vatikasher kol hachoma, and now. Vayikshiru kulam. The same term of bonding is used to refer to the stones of the wall and to refer to the enemies who are attacking us. Okay. So the enemy says, we are going to fight them, we are going to cause them to go astray, we're going to trick them, they won't see us coming, but we are going to attack. Let's see what happens. Back in chapter 4 once again, page 1845, and let's see where it goes. Vanispalel el Elokeinu. Sentence 3. Nehemiah says, we prayed to God. Notice once again, prayer is the initial response. And then he goes to a practical step. Vanamid mishmar aleihem yomam valayla mipneihem. We set up a mishmar, a set of guards upon them day and night. From before them. The guards upon them means either guards upon the builders, that's Rashi, or guards against the arrival of the enemy, that's Ralbag. He doesn't say what the guards are going to do if all of these nations show up. But we set up guards, so at least we'll know that they're coming. Okay. Vayomer Yehuda. And Yehuda said, Yehuda meaning the Jews who are supposed to be doing this building, Kashal Koach HaSabal. You know, it's really hard for us to carry all the materials. V'ha'afar harbei, there's an awful lot of dirt, right? Dirt that you're going to use to fill the gaps in the wall, dirt that you're going to use for the earthworks, for the defenses. V'anachnu lo nuchal livnos b'choma, we can't do it. So morale is low. It's one thing to say we set up guards, but everybody knows that you're toast if they actually come rolling into town. So you will see them first, and then you'll be dead. Like, what if we accomplished? There's some. It's expressed in terms of the difficulty of the labor, but the subtext is we're afraid. And in fact, the enemy says, "Vayomru tzareinu pasuk hay." Sentence 5. Our enemy said, "Lo yedu v'lo yiru ad asher navo al tocham v'haragnum." They're never going to see us coming. They're not going to know. They're not going to see until suddenly we arrive in their midst and we kill them. V'hishbasnu es hamalacha. And we will halt that work. It's very interesting, the hierarchy of missions here. Right? We're going to kill them, and as a result, the work will stop. That's their goal. The work is really the essence for them. The main thing is that we stop the work. So if you pause here, you know, you stop reading here, you think, well, that's it, it's over. All of these nations on all the different sides are going to invade at the same time. Sounds familiar? Right? They're all going to invade at the same time, and what in the world is our hope to be able to survive it? So here, the answer is that we have friends. The friends are Jews who live in the lands around us. Now, there are multiple ways to read Pasuk Vav, sentence 6. I had to sweat over this one because trying to figure out who was saying what. It's a very hard pasuk to render. Let's see what we can do with it. Vayehi kasher ba'u ha-Yehudim ha-Yoshevim etzlam. And it was when the Jews who lived next to them arrived, Vayomru lanu, and they said to us, Eser pe'amim, 10 times, Mikol ha-Mikamos asher tashuvu eilenu, from all the places that you would return upon us. If you understood that sentence, you know, you're a better reader than I am. I don't know what that meant. I'm looking at the art scroll. But then when Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, from all the places to which you return, they will come against us. That's marginally better, because they changed some of the words. But I still don't really grasp what it is that you're talking about. It's a very hard read. So I'm going to show you a few different takes. There are basically two different approaches. The majority approach is the Jews who lived among all of these different enemies were actually part of the military effort. And therefore, they were able to give us the secret to defend against the attack. That's the majority read. The Da'at Mikra has another possibility, that actually the Jews undermined our morale. It's just the opposite. We'll see that also. Well, take a look on your sheet, please. Source number 2 is Rashi's read. He says, Ve'ata ne'esfu hatzarim asher niskashru yachad, lavo lehilachim banu. Now all the enemies who had conspired together gathered to fight, im ha'yehudim asher hayu beinosam ba'aretzosam. And they had among them the Jews who lived in their lands. Va'osama Yehudim asher nischabru imahem bo'u lifnei hachayil kederech anshei ha'milchama ledaber eleinu. They actually showed up first, as warriors do, to speak to us. Now, the Zakheim book contends that this is like a military parley, where there's a formal meeting of the sides. I find that difficult to support for 2 reasons. Number one, knowing that these are Jews, you're not going to send them to your military parley. And number 2, we just said in the previous sentence that they're trying to do a surprise attack. You don't do a parley if you're doing a surprise attack. That defeats the purpose. So I don't think that that's what Rashi is contending here. Rather, what he's saying is, they come to us in the way that warriors do, meaning they're seeking, they're doing espionage, they're looking around, they're trying to figure out the way in. And when they came to do that, they also gave us the trick. They told us how to manage it. They told us the attack was coming. And that way they outwitted their enemies. And what they did was they told us, 10 times they told us that we need to gather, you have to gather from the places where you are on the wall to unite together to defend against the assault. In other words, they warned us, an assault is coming and you're too scattered. That's the idea as Rashi reads it. The variations in the commentators all take this as a given, as a basic, that these are Jews who are in the armies that are going to attack. So Ibn Ezra says it slightly differently in source number 3. He gidu lanu eser pe'amim. They told us 10 times. Ki mikol ha-makamos asher tashuvu le'eis ha'erev mi livnos misham chafetzim lavo aleinu mitachtiyos. He says, it's a little bit of a long sentence. What he says is, the enemy is watching. They see in the evening which parts of the wall we leave behind in order to go into shelter when we stop working. And that way they know where we are stationed. Makamos asher tashuvu sham means the places where you're currently at work and you leave during the night, and those are the spots that they're going to attack. That's the way Ibn Ezra reads it. Ralbag, also a little bit differently, source number 4, but the same basic principle. Mikol ha-mekamos asher tashuvu aleinu lehischabei sham lakum aleinu hodiunu elu ha-yehudim. He says, these Jews informed us about all the places where the enemy was going to hide for their attack. Asher tashuvu misham, the places where they were going to come from. Omar tashuvu, when he used the term tashuvu, ki kishayu ro'im, the places the enemies returned from, meaning the enemy would try here, and if they didn't succeed here, they'd try there, and if they didn't succeed there, they'd try a third place. They were constantly moving from position to position, and every time they did that, the Jews among them would signal us what was going on. Debbie, this is the action part. He said, and so to place after place. And then Nehemiah says, as we'll see in the next pasuk, when I knew where the enemy was going to hide, then what I did was I stationed people at higher areas above those low areas to see. And therefore, they could tell us what was coming. So the basic way that the various commentators are reading this, and again, the wording in the pasuk is clumsy. It's very hard to make it fit. This Asher Tashuvu Eleinu. But they told us over and over and over again, 10 times, which is a phrase that you find used in the Chumash very often, to refer to a lot of times. Right? Zeh Eser Pe'amim, Zeh Eser Pe'amim. Hashem says, they tested me 10 times. Right? Or Avram gets tested 10 times. They told us over and over what we should be doing in order to defend against the assault. You follow? That's the idea. That's our in, and that's how we survive. Again, the Dan Mikra has this other read. If you take a look at source number 5, Perush Acher, he has a footnote in which he suggests, Bo HaYehudim SheYashvu B'Shalom BeKerev HaGoyim and HisKarim Le'el Pasuk Aleph, those Jews who are living at peace among these nations came to us Va'amru Esef Pe'amim LeMisYashvim BeYerushalayim UBeYehudah. 10 times they told the residents of Jerusalem and Judea, Asher Tashuvu Eleinu, come back to us. Klomer Izvu Es Yerushalayim UBo LaShevet B'Mekamot Asher Anachnu Yoshim Sham. Get out of Jerusalem. Come live with us. You'll be fine. You don't need to try this campaign. It's a very different read. I'll tell you the truth, it fits the words better than what we've been doing. The only problem is that I don't understand at all then how the story flows. Because then there's no explanation of how it is that we knew where the attack was coming. Yeah, that piece of it is missing. So I'm not really clear on how that would work. Rabbi Zakheim, in his book, does a very interesting thing. He has like a full page on this in terms of the accusations we've faced historically of dual loyalty. Right? If you go back to the beginning of the 19th century, 1804, 1806, Napoleon conveys the assembly of Jewish notables, his Sanhedrin. And he challenges them. He says, I am willing to liberate the Jews. Jews in all lands I conquer will be emancipated. But I need to know that you will be loyal. And I need to know that a Jew in the French army who sees across the lines a Jew in the British army is going to fire his weapon. That's what I need to know. The challenge is, are Jews more loyal to their kin or are they more loyal to their country? And of course, the Jews respond with that classic line that they are Frenchmen of the Mosaic persuasion. First Frenchmen, and then Jewish. And therefore they will be loyal to the empire. But this has long been a concern, this accusation of dual loyalty. So what Zakheim does is he says, yeah, but there's a difference. He says, don't take the story of Nehemiah as evidence that Jews are not loyal to the armies in which they serve, because there, we were forced into duty in that army. We weren't doing it willingly, we were forced to do so. I don't know where he gets the idea that they were forced. The text doesn't seem to me to say that we were forced, but he's trying to draw a distinction because it's a very uncomfortable thing to recognize that this story could be used as a basis for accusing us and as a basis for undermining Jews. Okay. So, these people join us. By the way, from an archaeological perspective, interesting note, the Dat Mikra notes, something called Ktovet Kerem Zivadja. Anyone ever hear of that? I don't blame you, I hadn't heard of it either. The Ktovet Kerem Zivadja was a discovery made in the Ashdod area of a shard from the 5th century before the Common Era. I would show you a picture, but honestly, like, you can't see it from there, and even if you could, it doesn't look like much. But it's a shard, and the writing on the shard is I think it was Aramaic or Hebrew, but it indicates that you have Hebrew speakers living in this area in the 5th century before the Common Era, in the area of Ashdod. So that shows that you have this kind of a population back roughly at that point in time. Okay. So Nehemiah has inside information. Let's see what he does with it. Pasuk Zion, sentence 7.
Va'amid mitachtios lamakom me'acharei lachoma batzechichim va'amides ha'am l'mishpachos im charvoseihem romcheihem v'kashsoseihem.
I set up from below, behind the wall, in the tzichichim. Tzichichim are cracks in the rock. Tzichiach sela. They translate it here as what? Sorry? Cliffs. Okay. Well, the cliff idea would fit with Ralbag, who said that they were attacking from below and we defended from above. But he says, I set up people there by family, with their swords, with their spears, with their bows. So we'll be ready to defend in those spots that we have been warned about. Unclear to me if they are behind the wall or in front of the wall. In other words, it says me'achorei, which sounds like behind. It sounds like they're on our side of the wall. But on the other hand, if their goal is to see when people are coming, they need to be in the front of the wall. And in that case, behind the wall may mean the front of the wall is where we are, and they are on the other side. I wouldn't get hung up on it, but I think it's an interesting question. But he sets them up to fight as families. Why as families? Why are you setting them up to fight as families?
Loyalty.
Loyalty, very good. So the idea seems to be a loyalty point. If you take a look at Ralbag in source number 6, he says, Vihine, hemidam lemishpachos. He established them by families. Ki anshe mishpacha kishiyu yachad yischazku me'od kol echad ben anshe mishpachto. Because when a family is together, so then each one is reinforced to fight on behalf of his family. V'yazu ze'edze ezer nifla. And they help each other powerfully. So he says, I'm going to actually have the families all together to galvanize the warriors to defend the wall. That's the idea. Okay. Pasuk Ches, sentence 8. Vo'ere va'akum. I saw and I got up. I saw the need and I rose to rally the people. Va'omar el hachorim ve'el hasiganim ve'el yeser ha'am. I said it to the leaders and I said it to the rest of the nation. Al tira'u mipnehem. Do not fear. Es Hashem ha'gadol v'hanora zechoru. You remember God, who is Gadol v'Nora, great and awesome. V'yilachamu al achichem b'nechem uv'noseichem nishechem uvatechem. You fight for your brothers, you fight for your children, you fight for your wives, you fight for your households. He's rallying the nation to defend their families. Interesting note. Nehemiah is recording this for posterity, right? Why does he isolate the leaders in his address? Why does he say, I address the leaders and I address the rest of the nation? He's going to do it again in sentence 13. Why does he do that? So
they have the most to lose.
They have the most to lose. Could be. See, I think there are a few layers to this. Elisheva.
I was going to say, like, maybe a few reasons. First of all, I guess, politically correct. Like, it looks good if you address the leaders first. It doesn't look as nice to give them more kavod and more respect. And also, you know, maybe for the government to say, well, this is really the way it happened, and I wrote it down like this. You know, mm-hmm. So if there's any...
okay. Right. I think there are multiple things going on. I think that, first of all, some of it is, it's a good idea to give them special treatment. Right, to highlight them, they're charged with leading. But I think also Nehemiah highlights the attention that he gives them because he has to watch out for them. They are potential allies for the enemy. These are the people who were the ones in authority. If Nehemiah had never shown up, they would keep on living the way they were living. They were doing very nicely. Nehemiah has rattled the cage, so to speak. Right? He's challenged the status quo. He starts this project which brings the enemy upon them. And so Nehemiah says, the leaders are the ones who had something to lose. Right? The leaders are the ones who could have been just fine without Nehemiah. And therefore he has to give them special treatment lest they go over to the other side. I think that's another factor here. However, take a look at source number 7 from Reb Zakheim. He makes an interesting argument. The prefects were part of both his defense force and his target audience. Their participation was important not merely because of their seniority in Judah's society, but also because they were Jewish officials of the Persian administration. By including them among his forces, Nehemiah made it doubly difficult for Sanballat to attack. To do so would have meant assaulting officers of the Persian crown. They're not hostages exactly, but they are another source of protection. You follow? So that's your story here. The nations around them are all united. They're going to attack. Nehemiah gets the word from the Jews who live among them. Nehemiah structures his defenses to take advantage of it. And he rallies his people whose morale is low. And he says, we can do this. Think of God. Ellen, you're going to say? One side note here about Jews attacking Yerushalayim, these Jews who are in the foreign army, is that this is something we see elsewhere in Tanakh. In the first Beis HaMikdash, I gave you references, we're not going to look them up right now, but it's in source number 8. In the first Beis HaMikdash, Yeshaya describes hostility between Yehuda in the south and Yisrael in the north. And that actually Yisrael would have attacked Yerushalayim in the time of Mashiach, they wouldn't do that. And then the other example is in Zechariah. The 14th chapter in Zechariah, it's 14:14, as read by Rashi, has Jews being compelled to attack Yerushalayim. Here, though, the Jews who are being compelled to attack are also our allies. And they actually help us to survive the assault. Okay. So, the assault is prevented. There's no big drama. The assault is prevented. They decide not to attack in that way. But don't kid yourself. They will when they can. And so Nehemiah has to deal with that. And he goes back into his best bureaucratic mode. Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. Vayhi kasher shama'u oyveinu ki noda lanu. The enemy heard that we had found out their plans. And God had destroyed their plot, right? Credit goes to God. That's how it is that we won. Ish el malachto. So we all went back to work. And from that day forward, half of my youths worked. And then half of them were holding on, meaning they were holding weapons. They had the defenders had the swords, or you could say they had the swords, and they had the shields. Vakshasos and the bows, vashir yonim and the armor. Vahasarim acharei kol beis Yehuda, and the leaders were behind the house of Yehuda who were building. So you're trying to maintain construction forces. And you're trying to maintain defense forces. Havonim b'choma, v'hanosim b'sevel omesim. Those who were building the wall, and those who were carrying the burdens, were carrying burdens. V'achaz yado osev amalacha, with one hand doing the work, v'achaz machzekes hashalach, and one hand gripped the weapon. V'habonim ish charbo asurim amasnav u'bonim, and those who were building, they each had their sword bound to them. They were girded with the sword as they built. Seems a little clumsy to me. Vatokea bashofar etzli, and the trumpeter, the person who would sound the alarm, was standing with me. So writes Nehemiah. Did you notice something odd here? Malbim takes a lot of time to resolve this. I don't want to go into the depth that Malbim does. But there was a weird switch in these psukim. Who's doing the defenses? The youths. What are the youths doing? Just the defenses?
No, they're carrying stuff too. One man carries.
So there's actually a switch going on here. There's actually a switch. This is describing different stages within the process and different groups. At first, they said 50% will work and 50% will defend. However, then they became a little bit more comfortable and they said, you know what, we don't have to quite do it that way. We will build and we'll have our weapons with us as well. And there's a shift along with that in terms of whether they all work together or whether they spread out along the wall. The institution of the fellow with the trumpet to alert everybody is once they start spreading out, they feel a little more confident, now they need an alert system as well. And so he continues. Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. Va'omar el hachorim ve'el hastiganim ve'el yeser ha'am. Nehemiah says, I told the leaders, the free people, I told the deputies, I told the rest of the nation as well. Ha'malacha harbei rechava. There's a lot of work. Covers a broad space. And we are all scattered on the wall, each one distant from the next. And again, this is now that they feel more confident, but Nehemiah is worried. So when you hear the shofar blast from a particular site, Shama tikav tsu'eleinu, there you shall gather to us, Elokim yilachem lanu, and once again, God is going to fight, Elokeinu yilachem lanu, our God is going to fight on our behalf. Once again, every time he warns of something, he also says, don't be afraid, Hashem is on our side. Clear? Va'anachnu osim bamalacha, we were doing the work. V'chetziyam machzikim baramachim me'alos hashachar ad tesa kochavim. And half of them are holding the weapons, so now we've gone back to the 50-50, right? From first light until the stars emerge at night. Gam ba'esahi amarti la'am. And also at that point I said to the nation, Ish v'na'aro yalinu b'soch Yerushalayim. Let each man and his servant stay in Yerushalayim. Don't leave the city overnight. You have to stay here. Why? Fear of attack, meaning either that Yerushalayim could be attacked or
the workers.
If you leave the city, you're outside the wall. You can be picked off. So he says, I want everybody staying in Yerushalayim. V'hayulanu halayla mishmar v'hayom melacha. So the night was for guard duty. And the day was for work. By the way, I realized I did bring it on the sheet. Take a look at source number 9. That's Malbim. He says, Zaya Bahatzchala. This, meaning what you saw when we started reading this about the builders all having their weapons and them being together, that was in the beginning. Then they saw the enemy went home. They stopped being so afraid. Then each one went to his place, like was recorded in the previous chapter, to build Azamar Aleihem, and then he told them this. Okay. So, they are now working all day long, right? From first light all the way until the stars emerge at night. Interestingly, the Gemara in Brachos uses this to deduce halacha in terms of when the start of the day and the end of the day take place. Because here it says, from alos hashachar, from first light, until the stars emerged at night, and then in the next pasuk it says, and the night was for guarding, and the day was for work. So that tells me that this is the definition of night and day in halacha. It is first light until the stars come out, as opposed to sunrise, for example, or as opposed to sunset. This is the definition of Jewish day, correct? Based on this esoteric pasuk in Nehemiah. Okay. Ve'ein ani ve'achai una'arai. This is my favorite part. Ve'ein ani ve'achai una'arai ve'anshei ha'mishmar asher acharai. Ein anachnu poshtim begadeinu. He says, me, my brothers, and again, brothers, remember, I believe in Nehemiah, it does not mean brothers, you know, family, it means allies.
Unaharayim, my youths, v'anshei ha-mishmar asher acharai, and the people in the shift who were behind me, ein anachtu poshtim begadeinu. He says, we stayed in our work clothes all the time. Ish shilcho hamayim. The phrase ish shilcho hamayim is a very hard phrase to render, and the commentators do their best with it. Rashi says it goes back to the word ein. Ein anachnu poshtim begadeinu ish shilcho hamayim. We did not remove the clothing even when we went into the water. Even to go into the water and bathe, it didn't matter. We always were at the ready. The other way to take it, Ibn Ezra Metzudat David, says it means we didn't remove the work clothing unless we went into the water. If we had to go to the water to bathe, then we did. But other than that, we wouldn't do so. Why is this pasuk important? Aside from demonstrating the level of alert, why is this pasuk important?
They have the concept of mitzvah.
Yes. So part of it is definitely the issue of going to mikvah, but why else is this important? Oh boy.
Dedication.
It's Nehemiah putting himself on the line. Right? This is the hallmark of the good Jewish leader going all the way back to Moshe. Right? The good Jewish leader is working along with everybody else. He doesn't say, you go here, you go there, I'll watch. Right? He's supposed to go out to war with the nation. He's supposed to come back from war with the nation. That's his job. And so Nehemiah says, and he makes sure to put it in the book, right? For all time, for everybody to be aware, I was right there with them. Me, my entourage, all of us, we worked constantly. We didn't even dare to undress. We didn't dare to take a break. It was this was the way that we approached it, along with the nation around us. It's Nehemiah being in everything.
To be always ready, never to take your sword off.
Does it sound like it? When he gives you that kind of specification about the water?
I don't know whether there is any euphemism in it or not.
I mean, there's
the point. Never put your gun down.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure you mean euphemism as much as exaggeration.
Yeah.
There is exaggeration at times. We will. You know, the Meraglim, the spies come back and they say, we saw cities that were fortresses in the heavens. You didn't see fortresses in the heavens.
But we're like,
yeah.
It's
an impression that they're under, being their fear of the
enemy. We'll never bust out our swords.
Sorry?
The model is in heaven.
The model is in heaven.
We just did.
Okay. I don't think this is exaggeration, just because the way they phrase it. Like, we didn't do it. Either we didn't do it even to go into the water, or we didn't do it unless we were going to the water. It's a detail that I wouldn't expect if this were exaggeration. I think this is saying, this is what we did, and I did it along with everybody else. That's what he's saying. Yeah.
What is shilcho? I'm trying to understand.
Right, so this is a hard word to translate, and it's part of the problem here. We used the word shelach earlier in the parak to refer to a weapon. However, shelach is also lishloach, to remove something, to send something away. So most of the commentators here take it the latter way. Ish shilcho amayim, that you removed the clothing to go into the water, or did not remove the clothing to go into the water. However, I did see one, I don't remember anymore which one, who said that it's the weapon. And what it's saying is, we did not remove the clothing, and we did not remove our weapons. Even when going to the water. I did see that possibility.
Also, I was wondering about the syntax, and you, I find this Hebrew very clumsy, I don't know, it's very altogether. I don't mean poetic like Yeshayahu, I mean, it's just hard to understand.
Yeah.
So it says, v'chatiyam machazikim zeha v'machim. So, what is that about there?
Right. And the answer is that's why when I read it, I wanted to pause there and say, and half of them were holding, and they also had the swords and the shields and everything else. I see the way they do it here is just half of them held the spears and they don't seem to mind. But yes.
And later on there's not there.
Yeah. Correct. It's true. There are parts of this Hebrew that don't read straight.
It's very...
Yes.
I don't know who RV is, but that was the fellow who says that they took the swords into the water.
Okay. Yeah, I know who RV is either.
Well, I'll tell you in a second. I can find it. It's for the year.
Okay. RV.
Well, the, R dot V, yeah.
If an Ezra suggests that it, he's using that sort of an exclusion, except the one person who has to, either for washing or for...
Right, no, that's right. That, those are the two ways. Either it's Ibn Ezra and Mitzvah David who say, other than when going to the water.
Yeah.
No, that's true. The question was whether this shilcho is a reference to a weapon or not. That's where we're stuck. Yeah. Okay. So, believe it or not, we just did a complete parak. We just did a complete chapter. How do you like that? They and things happened, too. Yeah. But what happens in the beginning of the next chapter is fascinating. Take a look at Parak Hay. Chapter 5, sentence 1. I think we dare.
It's an argument, but it doesn't have to go into the water at the same time.
That's true.
You don't have to bathe 50 men at a time.
Yes. Vati. Take a look at chapter 5, sentence 1. I want to show that we did more than a parak today. So there.
Show off.
Yes. Vatehi tzaakas ha'am unsheihem gidolah el acheihem hayehudim. Well, the cries of the nation and the cries of the women were great to their brothers of Yehuda, meaning the Jews who were overseeing all of this work on the wall and all the defenses and everything else. The women in the nation were not happy. Now, that's not because of the lack of bathing that we just read about at the end of the previous parak and lack of laundry, but rather, v'yesh asher omrim, and some of them said, b'neinu uvnosenu anachnu rabim, v'nechadagan, v'nochla v'nechye. Some of them said, you know what, there are an awful lot of us, right? We have a lot of children. We need grain in order to be able to eat. V'yesha sherom rim, and some said, Doseinu chameinu vateinu anachnu orvim. We have these fields, we have these vineyards, we have these houses, we are orvim. What is an arev? An arev is a guarantor.
Oh yeah, of course.
An arev is a guarantor. These are under mortgage. Right? Meaning we had to borrow in order to be able to buy seed, in order to be able to plant, in order to be able to hire workers. We have to pay the bills. We need to be able to get grain in the time of famine. There isn't any food. And some said, Lavinu chesef lemidas hamelech. We have a different problem. We borrowed money in order to be able to pay the taxes of the king, right? Minda belova halach. Midat is part of minda. There's paying the taxes of the king. Sdoseinu, uchramenu, the tax for our fields, the tax for our vineyards. We have a real problem, and you know the men are needed here. You have us building and you have us defending and all that, but what about day to day life? You know, the Nehemiah, for a hero, has to deal with the mundane things that we don't find other heroes in Tanakh really needing to take care of. Moshe did, but the answer for Moshe is, no problem, let me pray to God, and God says, here is mun, here's a well, right? Their shoes don't wear out, their clothing doesn't wear out. All of these little needs are taken care of. Right? These are the things which have to go on a day-to-day basis and you don't normally read about in the stories, but that's what happens. Here you have a nation which was very afraid of attack, and therefore that was their focus. But now that the attack is no longer present, now they say, well, that's great. Now what about lunch? How are we supposed to afford to feed our families? Who's raising the kids? Right? That's the problem that they now are faced with. It's a very sort of pedestrian type of a thing, but Nehemiah is your man. Because of all the leaders we find in Tanakh, he is the one who likes to deal with administrative detail. And that's exactly what he has to do here. Sharon.
Well, there were a lot of people in the area before Nehemiah came with his group.
Yes.
Right? So there is a difference.
What do you mean?
Maybe in the way that they did not have to pay taxes to newcomers, but the people who had been there still had to pay taxes.
Right, so Nehemiah only came in with his entourage, right? He didn't bring in a nation. It's just his defense.
A nation, but there is a million difference,
right,
in what the various sectors had to pay as far as
right.
Right. Oh, so in other words, it's the people coming to Nehemiah and saying, you know, this is all well and good for you. Yeah. But we have issues.
Yeah.
Right. I hear that. For sure true. And, you know, you could make the same statement for Ezra, except that Ezra wasn't using the nation to build a wall. Right. In other words, Ezra also, when he came in, was exempt from all sorts of things. But
and
he didn't.
Supposed to be like him.
Right.
With a letter saying that so and so is going to give you.
Right.
Is
right.
Going to give you.
Right. Well, for the temple anyway.
Yeah.
And whatever needs Ezra chooses to define.
But there is a difference between those other people.
Right. It's true. It's a good point. So Nehemiah faces a population for whom he is privileged, essentially. So it's a good point as well. Good. So next time, God willing, we'll have to see how Nehemiah deals with the problem of actually running a country.